Good evening and welcome to The Blank Canvas, the show in which we speak about visual culture and creative community. I'm Amanda Coulson, I'm the Executive Director of the National Art Gallery of the Bahamas, and you're listening to 96.9 Guardian Talk Radio. Don't forget that you can always listen to us even when you are out and about by downloading the Guardian Radio app to your mobile device. And you can go to the App Store or the Play Store for that. And if you do not have a mobile device, or you're still carrying your bubbler, and you want to listen from your computer, you can just go to www.guardiantalkradio.com and click the live stream button. So tonight I have international visitors in the studio, which is always very exciting. We are welcoming colleagues from the Vizcaya Museum and Gardens in Miami, Florida. And tonight we are speaking with Wendy Wolf, who is the Deputy Director of Learning and Community Engagement, and Remco Jansonius, who is the Deputy Director of Collections and Curatorial Affairs. Didn't finish typing that on my little bit of paper. So welcome. Welcome to The Blank Canvas.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So which one of you is going to tell us a little bit about what the Vizcaya Museum is? Remco.
I am.
So tell us a little bit about what it is, and then why you might be interested in the Bahamas.
All right. So Vizcaya Museum and Gardens is a museum. It's been a museum since 1953, but it is really the estate that was built by James Dering on the shores of Biscayne Bay in the 1910s. James Dering came from Chicago. He was the vice president of this company,
International Combine Harvesters, right? I remember that. Listening at the talk.
Okay, all right, great. So he retired in 1908 and he went south and he built this winter residence in Miami. Mm-hmm. Miami was pretty much a wilderness at that time. It was the city of Miami had been incorporated only in 1896, but he chose South Florida because his father and his brother already owned some property there. So he bought 180 acres and he set out to build this grand estate, Vizcaya.
Yeah, I was very shocked when you showed the population count in that part at that time. You know, in the late 1800s, it was sort of 250 people crazy. And then already in the early 19s, it sort of, I think, tripled.
It was 1880s, it was about 250. By 1900, it was about 5,000 persons in Miami-Dade County,
And so the house itself is really, or how I knew it, so also I was really interested when you were coming over, because I really always thought of it as a house museum and a place where you saw European things, so furnishings and, because you spoke a little bit about how there's kind of industrial barons were trying to sort of give themselves credentials, whatever the opposite of street cred is. They wanted aristocracy cred, so they were building these sort of palaces almost to look like the palaces in Europe. And so I always sort of thought of it as a place that you go look at period furniture. But then after speaking to you last night, or hearing you speak, you know, you spoke much more about the kind of mission of the museum. So Wendy, why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Because I think for a lot of people who, you know, sort of like, why should I be interested in antiques? Like, what, like, what's that got it? So, and I think part of your mission is like engaging. So tell us a little bit. I learned a lot about the museum from your talk in terms of, you know, what your goals are and who you want to inspire and reach.
Yeah, absolutely. Vizcaya isn't one thing. It's really many things. We're a national historic landmark. We are an historic house. We're a public garden. And we also have an historic village across the street, which isn't yet open to the public as part of our ticketed experience. It's open for certain programs for school in the community. But our plans are to raise the funds so that we can restore it and open it, in which case we'll be about 50 acres open to the public. That includes the main house, an additional 11 historic buildings, formal gardens, mangrove shore, hardwood hammock, native forest. So, I mean, we're so many things. Our mission is really thinking about how we can connect to the past, understand the present, shape the future. The pillars that we work with are preservation, the arts, the environment, certainly history and social history. So exactly, I think for many years there was a perception that Vizcaya was one thing, maybe a decorative arts museum or an art museum.
Right, yeah. I think decorative arts is what I always sort of imagine, you know. And again, not to say there's anything wrong with that, but I think for many people, especially people who are struggling with you know, funding and things like that, it is always hard to justify art, and particularly all rich people stuff. Like, why should that be something relevant to us today? Why should we fund those things? And I think that's always a kind of really interesting conversation to have, because it is a sort of shallow way of looking at things. Because my husband always says, well, thank God for rich people, because they buy so much stuff and they employ so many people, right? So it's like, how do you tell that story about the things that the house represents beyond just stuff?
And for us, it's really looking at all of those pieces of the estate in cooperation and mm-hmm. together, and how one influences the other and how they work together, how they're parts that come together to make this really very unique whole that doesn't exist anywhere else, certainly in Miami, and is really uncommon even in the United States. So for us, it's really thinking about those interrelationships among the natural environment, the built environment. As Remco mentioned, we're right along Biscayne Bay. We're waterfront property. So when we're thinking about preservation, we're not just thinking about preservation of the collection objects and the architecture, but we're also thinking about the preservation and conservation of our natural environments. And we're also thinking about the preservation and conservation of the stories, the past mm-hmm. of the place and the people that lived there when James Deering was in residence, and how mm-hmm. they spent their time there, and how the estate developed over the last 100 years mm-hmm. into a public museum. So we're thinking about people, we're thinking about place, we're thinking about the innovation that it took to build the estate mm-hmm. in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. when it was such a small city mm-hmm. and had so few resources, really. Mm. And we're also thinking a lot about sustainability, again, mm. not just about the environment or the built environment, but the sustainability of what it means to be a museum.
Mm. Which I think is what all museums are sort of thinking about these days, right? And it's like, I think so many museums are really engaging in public discourse about social issues and using art or whatever their mission is, but let's talk about our museums because that's what we do, how we can have art connect to people in a way that makes them think about these really important things. The thing that struck me was the whole farming aspect. So I thought that was really interesting, and it made me think as well about how even in a state like that, back in 1910, but also, you know, I've been lucky enough to visit larger estates, and you realize that actually the way many of those estates were cared for was about sustainability, right? And this, you know, that let's say hunting in Scotland isn't simply a sport because rich people like to go shoot things. It's actually to cull the collection of deer and to get rid of the ones that are not healthy anymore. And so there is actually a kind of a curating aspect in the sense of caring for the landscape and caring for the population of animals that's actually very important. And my view of some of those estates changed when I spoke to the estate managers, like the people on the ground who were caring for the plants and the animals as opposed to the necessarily the structure itself. And I thought that was a very interesting part of your talk, was learning about the farming aspect and what you were doing with the community. Can you speak to a little bit about that, how that village sort of supported and sustained the environment that it was in?
Certainly. So the village itself, previously the estate in its heyday was about 180 acres. Mm-hmm. Today it's only about 50 acres. So mm-hmm. they had many dozens of acres of farmland and also sort of cow pasture right alongside what's now South Miami Avenue. So we're right in the urban core of Miami today. And there were row crops. So there was produce, vegetables, flowers, herbs, all growing in the village. Many dozens of rows and plots of these were planted. So there was a really very large harvest. And what we know from one of the resident gardeners' almanacs in 1922 is that any surplus produce that wasn't necessary for Mr. Deering, his guests, and the staff that were living on the estate was available Wednesdays and Sundays in a farmer's stand for people in the community to come enjoy the produce. And so we're really looking to that past to consider, well, how can we make that relevant in the urban core today? Mm-hmm. We don't have all of those acres. We're not in the position to plant all of these row crops, but mm-hmm. we can certainly create kitchen gardens, focus on edible plants, think about edible plants and tropical locations, some of the ethnobotanical implications of that. How do people use plants, whether it's for cooking or medicinal purposes mm-hmm. or otherwise? And how can we capitalize on those stories today in the urban core, how we can make that relevant?
So, yeah, well, it's interesting because, of course, you know, so many people are talking about urban gardening now. So it's, mm-hmm. in a way, it's sort of a great challenge that you don't have all the land you used to have, because it's like, how do we, in a city like Nassau as well, we've tried. There's so many empty lots if you drive around downtown Nassau, and that our families are arguing over who owns it. And it's like, how could we sustainably turn those into it's not cheap buying produce here. How can we turn those into urban gardens? So you sort of almost want that challenge of the contained space to see, okay, what can we do in this contained space? How many people can we feed from this contained space?
Absolutely. Use what we have. And mm-hmm. so many of the school students that will attend our urban farming programs in the village also are in a similar position. And so we want to give them the tools that they need to be, you know, growing in small containers in their kitchen or on their balcony or outside their door, wherever mm-hmm. they can, as you mm-hmm. say.
So how do you get the school group? I heard a myth. I don't know if it's a myth. I heard something from someone. I can't remember why, but I have people from Miami. I can verify it. That there is that certain age group in schools actually must go to museums as part of their school year. Is that true?
Well, a little bit. Miami-Dade County Public Schools has a variety of programs. So depending on the curriculum, for instance, in fourth grade, many students are visiting museums or cultural sites based on Florida history. Mm-hmm. So in certain grade levels, based on the curriculum, we'll get a lot of students. Mm-hmm. There's also a program in Miami-Dade County Public Schools started by the superintendent a number of years ago called Cultural Passport. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that every student in every grade will have some kind of cultural experience. Mm-hmm. And depending on your grade level, it could be an art museum, it could be an historic site, it could be theater,
but
dance.
They do have to go to X amount of in the course of their education?
Essentially one.
Yeah, okay.
And so that was...
Still, even one would be great here.
That was his idea, yeah. Essentially to try to make it accessible. It's a little tricky. I mean, we certainly run up against challenges with the school district in terms of when students can be off-site and outside of the classroom. Yeah. They like to save it for the end of the year, and a lot of our cultural sites will fill up at that time. So we do need to try to space it out over the course of the year, but it's a good intention.
Yeah. We actually started a program with, we found that one of the big challenges was actually getting the students to the place. Mm-hmm. That the first of all, the window of opportunity for things going wrong were from getting them from the classroom to the bus and then from the bus to the space, but also just the bus itself and the costs involved in that. So we've been very lucky in the Central Bank of the Bahamas actually sponsored something that we call the Magic Bus Program, which we're still running. So if anyone's listening, please use it, because we're sort of surprised how many schools haven't called us yet. But it's free buses for public schools to come, so that we'll provide the transport, because so often, you know, if your kids are at a private school, it's like there's a whip round. It's like, you know, parents send in your $3 or $4 and that will pay for the school trip, but the public schools are not always in the position that they can do that. So we've tried to partner, but what I would love to see is that, you know, you must go to at least a museum once in the 5 years of your primary education, and maybe once in the 4 years of your middle school education.
There are also a few what are called museum magnet schools in mm-hmm. Miami. Mm-hmm. And so they've worked very particularly in partnership with a number of museums to actually infuse the entire school curriculum with museum visits. And in those cases, those museum magnet schools, students will have more than one visit to a museum per year, and maybe visits to multiple museums in the course of a school year.
Yeah, very interesting. I actually had a visit from a charter school in Washington, D.C. that was trying to do that, because they have so many museums in Washington, D.C., to try to create a whole curriculum about museum visiting. And they actually came down here. They wanted to visit one international museum a year, and they chose the National Archives of the Bahamas. And it was great. And I have to say, to see the, and I expected it to be a bunch of privileged kids, but it wasn't. It was really like a group of very diverse kids from all different sort of socioeconomic backgrounds. And it was, I think, in our experience, what children retain after they've been in an environment like that is extraordinary. So anyhow, we're going to go to a quick break. We've been hearing mostly from Wendy Wolf on this section, who's the Deputy Director of Learning and Community Engagement at the Biscaya Museum and Gardens in Miami. But we are going to hear from Remco Yansonius after the break, because we're going to hear about why they're here and the people who built the museum and took care of the gardens. And that does, in fact, involve the Bahamas. So there you go. So stay tuned in. You're listening to The Blank Canvas, the show in which we speak about visual culture and creative community. I'm Amanda Coulson. I'm the Executive Director of the National Art Gallery of the Bahamas. And you're listening to 96.9 Guardian Talk Radio. We're going to be right back after this break.